Is there any evidence that Jesus really existed? That his disciples really lived? That he did miracles and went to certain cities? We're going to check that out today by visiting two sites that archaeologists have dug up that were Hebrew villages. Look similar to what you see behind me. Both on the Sea of Galilee. One's name is Capernaum. The other location's called Bethsaida. I got a chance to visit the ruins of Bethsaida many years ago. As you come around the backhand side, you see these beautiful black basalt walls from 1000 BC. It's back during a time that God's people broke their promises to God. They decided to live for a different God and not for Him. And you can see that even today. There's a statue right there at the gates. Looks like a bull with horns, a representative of a cow god named Baal. After thousands of years of not keeping their promises to themselves or to God, a group of simple Hebrew people decide to build a village on the exact same location, a reminder of their failures and a chance to do things differently. They even built a synagogue. They said, "We're going to teach our kids how to be true to themselves, true to God, learn how to forgive, and how to do the right thing." Now, if you walk through this little town of Bethsaida, the ruins are amazing. In fact, they have found the remains of a fisherman's house. As I walked by that many years ago, I could picture what it might look like. But you also found the remains of a synagogue, where people are saying, "We want our kids and our grandkids to do things differently than we did. Might they be the ones that keep their commitments to God?" Now we're in the first century. Jesus walks into this little village. As he does, he comes and finds not one, not two, but three of his disciples from this little town in this little place on the Sea of Galilee. A guy named Peter, someone named Andrew, and someone named Philip. Imagine the delight of all these parents and grandparents who've been training their kids up, waiting for the Messiah, the forgiver from God, for all these years, and he shows up to their little village and says, "I want three of your kids to come with me." And then, just nearby, he does a miracle. He feeds 5,000 people with a little bit of bread and a little bit of fish, all because they learned from their parents in synagogue.
So we'll start today in Bethsaida. And what we're going to do is we're going to do what I think a lot of us do when we try and discover what's true about anything in life. You start by going fishing for evidence, right? Is there any evidence for this claim? A lot of people claim things are true. What does it look like to go fishing for the evidence that it is true? As we look at those two cities today, we're going to try and ask the question, is the Bible Aesop's fables? Is it literature? Is it nice ideas? Is it just his story of what happened? Or is it history, what really happened? Right? There's a big difference between his story and history. If something is historical, we should be able to back it up. If something's historical, there should be evidence for the claims that it makes. Is the Bible really history? And of the four biographies we have of Jesus' life, do they substantiate themselves in history and in the rock? So we're starting today in Bethsaida. And Bethsaida is an interesting city. It's on the Sea of Galilee. If you look at our map here of the Mediterranean Sea, you see the area known as Israel. At the top section is a water section called the Sea of Galilee. And there we have our two towns, Capernaum and Bethsaida. However, archaeologists, as they've dug down here, we're going to ask the question, what are you building your life on? As all of us go fishing for evidence, I think we're also fishing for a rock. What can we build our life in that's secure? If anything, our culture is showing us, if anything, the world is showing us, is how little is secure. You can count on it. You can build a life on it. Is it possible to find a rock you can build your life on because it's true? Is there something you can place at the center of your life that you can anchor yourself to, even in the midst of all the ups and downs of life? We're fishing for a rock and fishing for a center point for our life. And when you do go fishing for stuff, that thing you caught, did it bring you the contentment you thought it would? You accomplished that goal, you met that 5-year plan, then you say, yeah, but why do I still have this dissatisfaction? Is there anything in my life I can fish for that brings joy and peace? Now, Bethsaida, the name literally means Beth, house of, Seda, fishing. It's a place of fishing. It's a fishing village. However, back in Jesus' day in the first century, as you see in that blue mark there, the water level was a little bit higher than it is. So there's actually two possible locations for Bethsaida. Most archaeologists think it's the northern one that's currently not near the water, but it would have been near the water in the first century. It's called Etel, and Tel can just be a name for a mount that a city is built on. So the two locations, one's called Etel, the other is called El Araj. The El Araj one would have been in the water during Jesus' day, so we're looking at the one Etel. As you'll see, archaeologists are pretty convinced this is the actual city Jesus' disciples were from. Now, we're going to walk along our map along the northern side of the Sea of Galilee. As you're walking along the side, it's just a beautiful view. If you're a water person, let me show you what it looks like. Just a gorgeous little section. It's a very small sea. We might call it a large lake, Lake Cumberland or Norris Lake. It's large, but it's certainly not the Mediterranean Sea. And as you walk along here, as Jesus would often walking across these paths, you'll see now, even today, it's a lot of agriculture. There's a natural amphitheater there. And one of the stories in the Bible says that right in this section behind me, Jesus had over 5,000 men show up, as well as women and children. And he preaches these messages, and people are so intrigued by what he says and what it looks like to center their life around him and his teaching and this new way of thinking about God. That one time on this very spot behind me is where he fed 5,000 people with just a few fish and just a few pieces of bread. Well, as you come along the waterway, you come up to where archaeologists have marked where they have found and dug down and found Bethsaida. They've even labeled it. I went there several years ago, and you can see big sign, location of Bethsaida at that northern location. If you look at this big rock here, you can see my reflection in there from taking the picture. It says the house of the fishermen. So they have found the fisherman's home. Just like Jesus' disciples are fishermen, they found actual locations marked today with those fishermen homes. Now, when you walk past it, it looks very much like a pile of rubble today. So an artist's rendering shows you what it would have looked like in its day. If you notice the architecture of these early Hebrew homes, there's an area where they would hang their fishing nets right there on those wooden planks coming out from the side of their living rooms and their kitchens. Hooks everywhere, fishing gear everywhere, all dating back to the first century. So that's what we find in the record, in the rock, when we dig down. So what does the Bible say occurred here? Well, one of the biographies written by a guy named John, and we have lots of biographies of this and documents of this, one is called Papyrus 66, we found. It says, now Philip was from this town called Bethsaida. Also mentions it's the city of two other disciples named Andrew and Peter. Now Philip has been checking out Jesus, asking questions, fishing for evidence, trying to figure out if Jesus' teaching and his claims is something to center his life on. A buddy of his shows up named Nathanael. And so Philip wants to tell Nathanael what he's discovered about Jesus. He says, hey, Nathanael, we have found him whom Moses, in the law, and the prophets wrote about. Now, let me tell you how radical that is. If you take the first half of the Bible, what we know is the Old Testament, Hebrews have been reading that book for 1,500 years. It has massive predictions that one day a Messiah would come, where he'd be born, near the Sea of Galilee, it says specifically. It also says he'd hang out in that area. He'd be living in a place called Nazareth, the place of the branch. It says he'd be born in an actual smaller town named Bethlehem, prediction after prediction after prediction after prediction. What Philip's saying here is, hey, you know that book we've been reading and our grandparents have been reading and our great-great-grandparents have been reading? Yeah. This guy we met fulfills all those ancient predictions. So this is not like, hey, he's kind of a cool guy with a cool personality. He's saying right here, we looked at the evidence and the predictions. This person fulfills that. Now, Nathanael's response is great. Jesus of Nazareth? Can anything good come out of Nazareth? Nazareth's like this hick town. It's like the armpit of the area. Oh, my goodness. Nobody's good. Nothing good comes out of Nazareth. And Philip doesn't get defensive, doesn't get all upset, doesn't start a big debate. He says, how about you come and see? Come check it out. Come ask your questions. I have the same questions. Why don't you ask Jesus what he's doing, how he's doing it, where he's born, what he has to say? So Jesus comes up to meet with Nathanael, sees Nathanael coming toward him, and he says this, the guy who just insulted him, insulted his hometown, Jesus says, behold, an Israelite indeed in whom there's no deceit. I like the blunt talk. I like the questions. I like you being direct. Let's have a great, honest conversation here. Nathanael's kind of struck by this. His personality turned people off sometimes, maybe. And he says, how do you know me? And they begin the process of dialoguing and fishing for evidence of who Jesus is and what he has to say. Now, if you've ever driven into our parking lot and you saw our logo, you'll notice our logo has a little pathway, right? Because we think all of us are on a path to find out what's true in life, what's the answer to the big questions, what's the problem and solution to life, what happens when you die. And so we believe there's a pathway between light and dark, and we want to help all of us make the next steps on our journey. We as a church and we as individuals have found that Jesus, that cross up there representing Jesus, that there's evidence to support it. His teaching, his way of living can bring forgiveness and joy and peace into your life. In the same way Philip says, come and see, our church's motto is simply, we are yours to explore. No pressure. You don't have to believe what we believe. But we're going to share the journey of how we've come to our conclusions. Like Philip said, just come check it out. Come and see. Let's have some fun doing it. Is it really true? Now, as I mentioned in the video, that's where we are in the first century. But years earlier, that town had not centered itself on Jesus or his teaching or his way. They'd centered themselves over that bull god. So this is a pretty amazing section of Bethsaida because this big black rock they have there was where this village dates back to something else the Bible claimed 100 years earlier. And as I mentioned in the video, you'll see that big bull there. That is with a big sword in his little sheath and his horns. That is Baal. So there's me there in the section of Bethsaida taking some pictures and looking around. So what is Baal? Well, you might say, well, those primitive people, they're bowing down to rocks. I mean, thank goodness we're educated and we know better today. Well, Baal represented something. It represented building your life on the rock of pleasure. If I just had more pleasure, if I just had more pleasure, then I would find happiness. He also represented building your life on might and power. He was known as a god who controlled the thunder and the storms. And so if you wanted to have a good crop or a good field, you would pray and build your life on Baal because he's the one that made your crops grow. It was like building your life on business, on power, on pleasure, on might, and on wealth. Then you suddenly realize that maybe the primitive people had a statue for it, but I think we all do that, don't we? We say, well, ultimate happiness or joy will come if I just get a little bit more power, just a little bit more might, just a little bit more pleasure, as if that's the thing to center your life around. But how many times have you centered your life around something, then you accomplished that thing, and it didn't fully and finally satisfy? Oh, it was good, but you thought the satisfaction would last a little longer. There's a writer from years ago. She writes in a little New York magazine, is probably the best way to describe it, called The Voice. And she's a sarcastic humorist with a little bit of dark humor. And she would see so many celebrities coming through New York, building their careers in the early 80s and beyond. She would see them set goals for themselves, think that thing, that rock, that thing they'd center on would bring them joy. And then she would see them accomplish all their goals and be miserable despite it. Here's what she writes. Again, a little bit of dark humor, but look what she's saying. Because that giant thing that they were striving for, that fame thing that was going to make everything okay, that was going to make their lives bearable, that was going to provide them with personal fulfillment, that was going to provide them with that ha-ha happiness, It had happened. And nothing changed. They were still them. Still unsatisfied. Still longing for peace. See what she's saying? We all have a giant thing that we build our life on. We all have something that we think if we could catch it, we'd find contentment. But then we do catch it, and we don't catch contentment. Then she goes on. This is where the dark humor comes. The disillusionment they have turned them howling and insufferable. I've come to believe that if God really wants to play a rotten practical joke on you, he grants you your deepest wish and then giggles merrily as you realize you want to kill yourself. Because you thought something temporal could fully and finally satisfy. Don't we all do that in some way? We all got some giant thing that we center our life around. Jesus comes up and says, I'm the one giant thing that can fully and finally satisfy. Or have you ever thought that you're a self-made person? So you build your identity on your ingenuity, on your work, on your efforts. It would be like this story, and I've told part of this, I'm gonna add a new part. What if I told a story like this? I am a fantastic fisherman, incredibly talented. I have pictures of me. This is me fly fishing. You can see the fly fishing I got. Here's me out deep sea fishing. I accomplished amazing things in my fishing career. I went out one time sail fishing, and in 3 hours I caught, I think it was 750 pounds of fish in 3 hours. Amazing. You want advice about fishing? You want to know how to find joy and happiness? You want to know how to build your life on strong effort? Sailfish, tuna. It was an amazing day. And I've done it several times. Caught hundreds of pounds of fish in a few hours. Now, most of what I said to you contained facts. Now let me tell you the part of the story I didn't mention. I'm out sailfishing on a buddy of mine who bought a boat specifically for sailfishing and for kite fishing. While on that boat, the captain took us to a place that he knows to catch fish all the time with a whole crew that were loading up all of the fishing poles the whole time. What was I doing? I was eating crackers with my wife. Crackers and cheese, to be specific, and a little bit of meat. And suddenly, of the four lines that the crew had put out and the captain had driven us toward, they get a line pull. We got one! I got one. So I get up and I come to the back of the boat where they have what looks like a barber chair. I sit down in the barber chair and now I am fishing. And here's the part I haven't told you before. So I sit down, they strap me in, they hand me the pole. They then take the rest of the poles away so I can catch a fish. And the rule they give me is you cannot switch hands. You've got to only pull in with one hand. Yeah, sure, I think I'll be fine. So I am reeling. And I'm reeling. And reeling, and reeling. 30 minutes go by, and I'm reeling. And I'm like, holy cow. I'm like, can I change hands? No, you can't change hands. You can't caught it. Oh, my goodness. I am so worn out. But I can't believe. I'm like, so I turn to the crew, and I'm like, this fish is really fighting. This is amazing. I can't believe it. My arm's getting worn out. He looks at me like, you're not feeling the fish at all. What? You're just feeling the weight of the line. What? All my best efforts. I think I'm pulling in a fish. I'm just fighting the weight of the line. So another 20 minutes goes by. And then finally we catch up to all that leader of the fish. And now I can feel it. Boom, tuna jumping, sailfish jumping. It was amazing. And I pull this thing in. Sure enough, they come around and help me as we pull it up, snap the pitcher, pull it in, put it into the well where all the fish go. Man, what an incredible fisherman I am, honey. You know, I did catch the fish, and they did say it was actually a pretty amazing lucky day, but it wasn't really my effort. It was somebody else's provision, somebody else's expertise, somebody else, right? If anything, I got humbled to realize I could barely even pull in the line. God says we need something bigger than us, bigger than our effort, bigger than the things we take credit for, even the self-made man stuff we tell ourselves, not accounting for the talents and skills that we got from maybe our creator. What if there's something else we could center our life on that's transcendent? That's why if you watch the movie Raiders of the Lost Ark, The question is, what's inside the Ark of the Covenant? And they open it up, if you remember, and all these weird spirits and ghosts come out and swing around, and the lid goes all the way up into the sky, and then suddenly there's some Nazis that faces all melt out, and you're like, wow, what's in the Ark? Today I'm going to tell you what's in the Ark. Not a bunch of ghosts. The Bible says that when you open up the Ark, God told them to put three main things in there. One was a copy of the Ten Commandments. Was in there. Reminder that God wants at the center of your life to be a source of truth. In fact, when the Israelites would be traveling around, this ark would be in the very center of all of the campground. So center your life around knowing that I can be a source of truth in a world where everything seems as squishy as jello. The other thing that was in the ark, in the center of it, they kept inside, was that they called manna. And it was the way in which God provided daily bread for them for 40 years. God's saying, I want you to trust me to be your source of truth, but also to provide for you daily. The third thing, strangely, was in there was a staff that had some flower buds on it. Because there was a time in the Israel history that they were fighting over this guy named Aaron, and they didn't think he was God's leader. So other people were trying to throw a mutiny against him. So they all brought out kind of a dead branch. And God says, bring out your dead branches. I'm gonna show you who my leader is. I'm going to guide you and lead you into who my leader is. And so they all bring out their dead branch. And all of a sudden, Aaron's branch buds. It's the first time in the Bible that God says, this bud's for you. Yeah. Second line is mine. But that is what happens in the story. And he says, hey, this is my leader. Stop being stubborn, stop being mutinous, stop thinking that you know better than other people. And so they kept this in here as a reminder that God guides. Then at the top of the ark are these two angels. And these angels represent God's justice against evil, coming down against evil in the center section. And it was called the mercy seat because God wanted to provide mercy, but he also wanted to be just. So something would die, a lamb or a cow, and you would put the blood here as a way of absorbing God's justice so you could find forgiveness. So God was saying that what he wants to be is in the center of your life. He wants to be a source of truth, guidance, manna, or provision, and forgiveness. And Jesus is going to come to say the same thing. I am the mobile presence of God like the ark was. I am a source of truth, and only the truth can set you free. I am, he even calls himself the mercy seat, the propitiation. I am the one that can ultimately bring forgiveness in your life, and I'm the one that can lead you. What do you have in the center of your life? And when you center yourself on that and catch that, does it provide the contentment and joy and forgiveness and guidance you want? Jesus says what he offers can do that in Bethsaida. But now we move to Capernaum. Now, Capernaum's pretty important as a city because Jesus spends 3 years here. He spends the most amount of time here. This particular location is where he hangs out and always comes back to, like the hub of all the work he does for 3 years in his public life. And here we're going to try and fish for evidence for Jesus in 3D. So you can see Capernaum's at about maybe 11 o'clock, 11:30 on our clock of the Sea of Galilee here. We're going to try and see Jesus in 3Ds with 3Ds, the documents, the digs, and then ultimately the disciples. Is there evidence for it? Let's start with the documents. So we actually have 4 biographies of Jesus. That's unheard of in the ancient world. No one doesn't even have 1 biography written about him unless you bribe somebody to write propaganda about yourself in the first century. We have 4 different biographies. And look what they say. Jesus, he dwelt in Capernaum, which is by the sea. So this should be a city called Capernaum, should be next to the sea. And Jesus, walking by the Sea of Galilee, not any sea, the Sea of Galilee, saw 2 brothers, Simon called Peter, okay, there should be a disciple there. And Andrew, his brother, casting a net, they should be fishermen, for they were fishermen. And he said, follow me, I'll make you fishers of men. All right, so that's 1 document written by a person who used to work for the Roman government named Matthew. Now we got a separate biography written by Luke, an ancient historian and a doctor. He separately writes, then Jesus went down to Capernaum, a city in Galilee. Ah, now we know it should be on the left side of the Sea of Galilee. And was teaching them on the Sabbath, and they were astonished at his teaching. When he spoke, it wasn't a bunch of rules and regulations. It was like with authority, it rang true. So here's a copy of a biography we have called Papyrus 75. Now, we have a whole other one written by a guy named Mark. And of the biographies we have about Jesus and his disciples, we call the New Testament, we have over 25,000, up to 30,000 copies. There's no document, there's no historical ancient event that has more documentation than Jesus' life. You don't have to believe it, but if you're not going to believe the documentation for this, put a question mark over anything from the third century and before. It's that much documentation. And what does Mark say? Then they went into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath, he entered a synagogue. So there should be a synagogue in Capernaum, according to this documentation. And Jesus taught there, and they were again astonished at his teaching because he taught like one who has authority. So what is a synagogue? Where is Capernaum? And did this really happen? And what does digging into the soil tell us? Well, there's an archaeologist in the 1960s who dug down. We're going to watch and see as we step into an ancient synagogue as recreated at the Museum of the Bible. Let's watch.
Now, a synagogue, like the one I'm in right now, was a place people would come to learn about the Bible. Some people grew up with the Bible, they'd ask questions. Others who'd never read the Bible would come in and say, I'd like to learn some things about what you believe and why you believe it. So a synagogue is a place you'd come in, and they'd have scrolls, copies of the Bible, in that back cabinet. You'd pull it out, roll it out, people seated on different levels to the left and to the right, and you would ask questions, you would dialogue, you get to work out where you were and what you believed. Not only was there one that we found the remains of in Bethsaida, but there is a massive one in Capernaum. And here we have discovered that this was an actual location where Jesus used as his ministry center. He would go off, come back, go off, come back to this location. In fact, in the 1960s, they were digging down in this location and they found what they believed to be Peter's actual house. And then later, it looks like a giant octagon sitting on top of those remains. That's the remain of a church. A quirky octagon church from about 450 AD, built here to commemorate the Apostle Peter, a follower of Jesus, and what he did to change the world. When you walk up today, you're gonna see a monstrous, beautiful synagogue. Most of the pieces still remain today, and it is beautiful. But they look at the base, and the base of this synagogue that just takes your breath away when you see it today, it's got both black and white rock. A smaller, simpler synagogue that existed during Jesus' day was on the same base. So picture this beautiful one that's there today, but picture one like this. It says that Jesus would walk into this very location and this very synagogue and describe himself as the one sent from God to come and forgive, to live. He says he'd even die and raise himself from the grave, surprising people in a place like this. What can we discover about life if Jesus really existed, if his disciples really existed, if the places he went and the things he did and the places he taught really happened? What did he have to say? How does it apply to us today?
So there you have not only the documents, but you have these digs. And so sure enough, massive synagogue right there next to the Sea of Galilee as recorded. And as I mentioned in the video, when they dug down underneath this white synagogue, the white stone, is this black basalt stone dating back to the first century. Which again, we go back to one of our biographies from the documents in Luke, and Luke says, Jesus entered Capernaum and he's going to heal a centurion, it's a Roman soldier. And that Roman soldier, we get a little detail here, and a certain centurion so loved the Jewish nation during that time, which was quite a contrast to most of Rome, that he built them a synagogue. Just like the documents say, there's an actual synagogue, simpler, built by a centurion in Capernaum, right there in the black basalt rock that Capernaum is known for. One artist's rendering shows what it might have looked like from the outside, and the inside for that matter. A very simple place that people would come and ask the big questions in life. Learn about those ancient predictions and whether or not Messiah, or if you didn't grow up being a Christian or a follower of the God of the Bible, you'd say, tell me about this. I grew up with different gods. Why do you think that's true? And there would be dialogue together. Those are the digs. Those are the documents. The thirdly is the disciples. Is there any evidence for the disciples? We already saw some there in Bethsaida, but now we see it in Capernaum. See, there's a modern church there today. It looks like a UFO landed there. That's actually a modern church, that new octagon one, on top of the older, ancient octagon one underneath. And so when they began to dig down into the dirt, they found multiple layers, like last week at Mom Ray, of all the different buildings. People have been marking this spot all the way since the first century. And underneath that modern church, you see underneath there all these rocks. They found, sure enough, a fisherman's home. It's a large home, big enough for 10 to 12 people, because Jesus hangs out here with 12 disciples during those 3 years, exactly as the Bible recorded. So if you're fishing for evidence, did this really happen, isn't really true, we see it all occur right here. Now it's into that, that there's an archaeologist in the 1960s, as I mentioned, and here's his name, Virgilio Cano Corbo. He's digging down, and he's the one that uncovers both the synagogue as well as this house of Peter. Confirms the fishing hooks, confirms the location, confirms all the documentation, says, we found the house of the Apostle Peter. And he's just jaw-struck by this. He also notices that there's lots of synagogues all around that area, and they always point toward Jerusalem, which is almost directly south from this particular one. Which means if you come out, the synagogue would have been that top left one, what it would look like in its day. You come out the front door of the synagogue, and you're literally 30 feet away from where Jesus hangs out for 3 years. Jesus talks and speaks in that synagogue, shows that he fulfills predictions made hundreds of years ago in that synagogue. He delivers a guy from evil right outside the doors of that synagogue. He hangs out there with his disciples in that big house to the right-hand side. 30 feet away, as you saw in the photographs there. Many people think from the book of John that somebody tears the top of Peter's house down and lowers their friend down. He heals their friend there because of one of the records. So here, like, you ever heard somebody, maybe you said to yourself, if I just had evidence God existed, if I just had evidence of Jesus, if God would just appear to me and give me evidence, I would believe. The people who visited this synagogue had evidence within 30 feet of them for 3 years. Surely seeing those works, those miracles, those predictions, those fulfillments, surely they would believe. But they don't. Do they lack evidence? You can always have more, but that's a lot of evidence. So Jesus comes and challenges them, and he mentions these two cities by name in a little speech he gives. He says, Bethsaida, if the mighty works which I have done in your place were done in Tyre, a city that was destroyed hundreds of years ago, they would have changed their mind and repented and turned to God. You don't lack evidence. I've given you plenty of evidence. There's something wrong in your heart. You keep choosing to think you know better than God and everyone else. He says, Capernaum, you who are exalted in heaven, you think you're so smart, you think you got it all figured out, you think you know everything that you know. If the mighty works that I've been doing right here in front of your front door that you have seen for 3 years have been done in Sodom and Gomorrah, that city would still be here today. You don't lack evidence, Jesus says. You're actually lacking belief. So how about you? As a church, we encourage you not to check your brain at the door but go looking for evidence. But how much evidence would be enough? And if you're serious about evidence, are you actively searching out for that evidence, trying to find it? Are you asking big questions? Have you talked to people about the best arguments on both sides? Is there something in your life that you feel like if I centered my life or built my life around this, it would bring me forgiveness? It would bring me peace? Is there a way to accomplish my goals but also know there's something I anchor my identity and my value to that's not just more status, more approval, more money, or more power? My encouragement as we go through this series to you is go fish. Go fish for things you think will satisfy. Accomplish all your goals. And you might find they don't fully and finally satisfy. So then ask another question. Well, if this doesn't fully and finally satisfy, go fish. What might? Jesus turns to fishermen, and he doesn't say stop fishing. He says, I know you're fishermen, but let's add something to your skill set. Follow me. Follow me. And I'm going to make you fishers, same skills, same passions, but a fishers of men. We're going to change the world. Becoming a Christian doesn't mean if you're a lawyer, you have to not be a lawyer anymore. If you're a business person, it doesn't mean a business person anymore. It's I'm going to take my fishing skills, my business skills, my mom skills, my dad skills, my whatever your passions are, whether it's artistry or working with numbers, I'm a fisherman. But I'm going to now add to that following Jesus in that skill set, and I'm now going to build my identity on something secure. I'm going to build my identity out of knowing that peace and joy comes from not anchoring into my own efforts or my own accomplishments, which often produces pride, but into the humility of knowing there's a God, that he loves me, that he works in me, that he wants to work through me. And to hear this in real time, I have a friend who's been coming to our church for about a year, and he came to our Christmas service last year, and as he came face to face with this idea of being distinct and being different within his own identity of following Jesus. Look what happened in him and through him. What it looked like for him to follow Jesus by fishing for the evidence. Let's watch.
So we came to Horizon in 2021, I think it was.
I believe so.
Yeah, and we started virtually and really enjoyed the service. We had done virtual for a while just in the midst of COVID. Through college, we kind of probably had more of a normal college experience with, you know, partying and drinking mm-hmm. and having fun in those ways. On December 22nd, I went to the Christmas carols and readings service that we had and just felt a pull on my heart. That almost like God was speaking to me through that service, which, you know, was a kind of straightforward Christmas service, just of songs and of readings from the Bible. And just felt like an overwhelming joy in my heart. It was probably more in the days that followed that I decided, you know, I'm going to turn away from some of the previous ways that I lived.
He's come to terms with that he wants to follow Christ wholeheartedly, authentically, and I think it's fabulous. And that was always a prayer that I prayed, that he would get that authentic heart for Christ.
Is the answer to your prayer?
It was, but God answers prayers in many different ways. Yeah. Not always the way you're expecting, but it was definitely a wonderful answer to prayer. But when you live a way that you live for 16 years, some change is hard.
So this was such a big change in my life. I felt that I had, in a way, been born again. I needed to be alive again in Christ as Randall instead of Randy. I always went by Randy before, and now I go by Randall. I gave my life over to him and was just different. I was a different person almost.
How about you? Are there ways in your life that you're less than perfect? Areas in which you might want to be different. Not change your ultimate personality, but imagine the best version of you, centered on something secure, so you don't have to be defensive, you don't have to react, you don't have to always be discontent and clawing for one more thing when you thought that last thing was supposed to be the last thing that would bring you joy. Maybe you want to make that song a prayer. It may lead you into prayer. If it's helpful, you can close your eyes if that helps you. But we're just talking to God. I just say, God, I'm less than perfect, and I'm looking for something to center my life on. And today I want to trust you in the center of my life as my source of truth, my source of guidance, my source of provision. And because of your death on the cross, my source of forgiveness. Help me build my life with you at the center. In Jesus' name, amen.